not in your 20s or something, but somewhere in your mid-30s, where you've got enough balance and enough disappointment to sort of balance you out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think ultimately it's about your relationship with your art, right? Yeah. And that's because validation, external validation is really, really wonderful, but it does fade in the end, right? Yeah. But what doesn't fade is the incredible intimacy you achieve with your characters and this long relationship you have with the projects.
Right.
No one, like, whatever the reviews are or awards or not awards, no one changes that. That's between you and the thing.
It's so true, right? Do you like building sentences? I still will get up from my desk sometimes and like fist pump or like high five whoever's around me. And there's still this exhilaration that comes from doing something well, regardless of anyone has seen you do it or not, right? There's something like acrobatic or really, it's like the mental equivalent of like gymnastics or something. Like I finally could do a backflip, right? I finally solved that thing. I got it, and there's like nothing like it, right? I don't mean to wax all sort of cheesy or anything like that, but there really is nothing like doing something impossible.
And then there's all those days where you fail and you fail and you fail and you fail and you're like, wow, what am I doing? Should I be writing? And I should just give up now.
What do you do with your disappointment? Like,
what do I do with
that? Does it knock you down? Are you someone who stays low for a long time? Or
I really go between the two states very often. But I had this wonderful professor, Elizabeth McCracken, during my MFA, and she said, it's the kinetic energy between the failed state and the genius state that drives your work. It's the movement between the two.
Oh, wow.
Because you don't want to stay in either state very long, right? Both are self-destructive, actually.
We talked about this one time, right? Like, the amount of energy even, like, good news takes from you, right? Like, you get this great news about the Booker, but you just can't operate at this frequency of happiness all the time, right? Like, you just can't go through breakfast, lunch, dinner for weeks super excited about this. At some point, you know, you've got to take out the recycling and like that will bring you back to, like, everyday feelings. So,
yeah.
How are you for time?
I think we should open it up to questions.
Okay, let's.
Okay.
So, Sarah, there's going to be a mic in the middle, right, you said? And then...
Yeah.
And then any questions about books, about writing? Do people expect you to be a political expert on Ukraine-Russia?
Sometimes yes. I feel like, sometimes. And I always say that I am one person and I cannot speak for a nation, even Zelensky cannot speak for a nation, and that there are so many different lenses to look at a war. And I mean, we're still talking about World War I, World War II,
right.
And we're going to be talking about the war in Ukraine for a very long time. And it's the kind of layering of all those different perspectives that will give us an understanding. But there's no one single perspective.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Any thoughts or questions in there? See folks coming.
Thank you very much, both of you. You both talk about, or you both write with very interesting structures and changes and switches and echoes from previous chapters and the train going off the tracks and so on. When you're doing that, are you thinking about, this is going to really challenge the reader? Like, are you actually thinking about how the reader is going to engage with those interesting structures, or if they're expecting this? So, and if I take them that way, I can push them into a different place than just a sort of typical straightforward narrative.
Yeah.
I can go for that. So, I, as someone who works in the opera field and who has an older sibling who's a composer, I've gone to a lot of contemporary music concerts. And some of those pieces are so... it's almost like the composer really doesn't care about the listener at all, and they're just kind of banging a metal bucket with a spatula and like, look what I can do. So, and I really don't want to be like that. So I do think about the reader, and I want to engage with them. When I was writing this, I watched Everything Everywhere All at Once, and I imagine a lot of people here have seen it, and you probably remember that there is a fake ending in the middle of that movie, right? And the credits start to roll. And I saw that movie in the theater twice, and both times nobody got up from their seats, right? So we have this intrinsic sense of narrative, right? So when an ending is not satisfying or it's too early, we're like, no, I'm gonna sit here and I'm gonna wait for the real thing.
Right.
And everyone sat in their seats. And that's what gave me the courage to do something like that in my book, because there's also this, you know, at the point of derailment, the book also ends, right? And there's an acknowledgement section, there's note on type, etc. Because at that point, I did believe that the reader would sit with me for that, because they would know. The reader is very smart. They know that that's not the real ending, that there has to be something more.
Yeah. It's so good to hear you say that. Think about contemporary music. How many times of violins are screeching and like you can't hum along to anything, you can't count. I feel similarly. And my thing is like rule number one, like respect the intelligence of the reader, and I think readers will get it. My thing is I don't want to abuse trust, right? If a reader stayed with me for a while, you don't want to abuse trust, you want to give a reader payoff that's reasonable. And also, if things are about to get complicated, there should be some indication of what's happening. You've been preparing the reader. Someone said, every book teaches you how to read it. And so I would just drop something out of the blue with no precondition to it, right? There are these cues that the sensitive reader will pick up on. And when it something changes, they'll be like, oh, yeah, that's weird, but that makes sense. I can go with that.
And sometimes you do lose readers.
True.
And you do, and you can't really control for that either.
We
think of the reader who will understand.
Yeah, you kind of hope that those readers will pick up the book again at some point, too. Maybe a little bit later, it's not the day for it. Yeah.
I'm going to apologize for the sports analogy, which seems very popular these days, but you talked about that feeling of, wow, I've got it right, sorry, hitting the home run. Mm-hmm. And you talked about that feeling of, ugh, I got it wrong, the strikeout. So how do you know about those moments? How do you recognize that? And are you right all the time?
Oh.
That is such a good question.
It is a good one. Because it's more than just a feeling, right? Like, you get that exhilaration, you get like these blasts of dopamine in your brain that says, aha, this is working. But for me, there's a kind of mental clicking where my questions about that issue evaporate, right? Like, this has left enough of an imprint in the book, whatever I'm doing, that I know, oh, there's future and potential here, there's direction here. So it just kind of like, it feels right, sure, but it also satisfies a number of like pre-existing criteria, and all of those like anxieties just go hushed, right? They go to quiet. That's a knowing I got it right sense. But I feel disquieted if they're wrong. What do you think?
If I'm bored by my own writing, that's how I know something's not going right. But sometimes I have to just keep writing into that boredom until I hit something interesting. So I'm constantly reading my own engagement with my work. It's a really finicky thing, because sometimes you think you hit the home run and whatnot, and it turns out, no, you were just in a good mood. Heather O'Neill said this, and she's like, yeah, and then you read it the next day, and you're like, oh, that doesn't work. On a broad example, the totally other novel I wrote when I gave up on this one, I was way too excited about it when I showed it to my agent, and that should have been a red flag for me. So it hadn't, I was kind of in that upward trajectory, right, of excitement, and it hadn't gone through the wash cycle of dejection. Dejection, change, revision, and oh, slightly better, and then more dejection, oh, okay, a little bit better. So you kind of go through that wash cycle multiple times, and I hadn't done that. And that was a good lesson for me, that if I'm too excited about something, maybe wait a little bit.
Time, right? There's no substitute for time to give you clarity on something, yeah. It's true.
I have to use audiobooks now. And one of the presenters this week said they certainly would not read their own book. But I had an Ann Michaels book that she read and it was wonderful.
Which one?
Held.
Is it Held? Yeah.
Yeah. So I just wanted to encourage you to read your books on audio.
What do you think?
I mean, I did. So with this book, because I come into it as a character, there are chapters written through the I perspective, right? And as myself. So the producers of the audiobook did ask me to read those chapters. And at first I said no, because I'm not a professional actor. I didn't want to bring down the quality of the audiobook. But I sent them samples. They liked them. I worked with a really, really good director. And it was actually a really difficult process, to be honest, because those were the most, of course, personal chapters, and it was in the practicing for the audiobook that it finally hit me what I wrote about the war, and it was a really emotional process. Yeah,
I think for like nonfiction, I feel okay like reading stuff. For fiction, Random has sent me like the audition tapes of some actors. And, you know, there were three of them, and I heard, like, the third one. I was like, that's the guy, right? This guy, of course, can read it, like, better than I can. He got Gluten, he got Princess, he got Beckett. He was just, you're a trained professional, right? You're an actor, you know how to do this. And I would prefer to, like, trust the professional, trust the design people, trust the folks who know their jobs, instead of thinking that because I wrote the story that I know everything and can do everything better than the folks there. So maybe nonfiction, you could hear my sort of personal connection or blunders, but for fiction, I think I'm okay. I'm okay with having other folks do that. Have you heard the audiobook?
Well, I got one that felt like it was a machine reading it.
Oh.
So, yes, I'm sure some actors are all right.
Right, yeah. I don't want the audio text, but Ann Michael's reading anything, right? It's going to be very sonorous, yeah.
I was building on that audiobook comment because I also, because of time and everything else, have started using audiobooks a lot. But I find you've talked a lot about form, container, arrangement, whatever you want. Whether something makes a good audiobook is very dependent on the form or the structure of the book. And more people are using audiobooks. So I wondered whether you personally ever thought, how is this going to sound as a performance when you're writing, or whether you think other books are starting to be affected by the different ways people are reading now?
Yeah, that's neat. So voice is never too far from me, and voice is a literal thing, right? Not just like the voice of the author or whatever. And I do sort of take particular delight in like conversational parts of books, and so I'm always thinking about like, this is going to translate well, or in reproduction there are those whole sections that are just dialogue, right? Like, no narrative at all. And so,
But you do talk about using different fonts and like, which is something that's physical, that's visual.
Right.
You both seem like you're quite visual thinkers, the way you talk about your stories.
Yeah, but there's an apt translation from like the visual into the auditory. And so for like those, we talked with the producer about this, for those faded out texts, there's this kind of almost like mosquito-like thing that you hear, right? Something in the distance that is not in the reel of the story, and there's a little bit of like echo or mutedness there. The words that are blacked out, you'll hear like a tape sort of crossing, like being pulled. And so there are these, it's pretty much an issue of coding, right? The book is coded both to be like read out loud and also to be read privately and internally and all that. And a good producer is able to find those moments and those metaphors that to kind of translate into the auditory.
And were you thinking of that when you were writing?
Maybe not so specifically about the audiobook, but like the first part of the book, there's no first line. It fades in from the white page, so you just see it becoming less gray until it becomes black. And so this is just like it was a musical analogy. It was like this volume being turned up. So you hear like Beckett mumbling in the beginning of the book, and eventually you hear him at full volume. So that's a pretty easy kind of like translation. So yeah, I do think about it. I do. Yeah.
For me, I didn't think of the audiobook so much. I did think about the opera stage when I was writing this, because that's just an image I have often and in my head when I'm working on something. But kind of, you know, the beginning chapters are almost like arias. Each character is presenting themselves, their inner world. They're singing these long arias for us. And then once the characters start to interact and their worlds are intersecting, it's like the duets start to form. And then in the great climactic scene is where everyone's on the stage at the same time, there's smoke machines, everyone's trying to sing over each other. So I thought about it in that way. So when the audiobook was being produced, there were conversations with the director about how to adapt it. Because as I mentioned, there's a fake ending in this book, but I felt so done with it, I just wanted to wrap it up. And credits start rolling, etc. And we worried that, okay, if someone's listening to this in their car and they hear the credits rolling, they're gonna turn it off. And they're gonna be like, wow, that's a bad ending. And maybe, some, you know, hopefully like with Everything Everywhere All at Once, everything, you know, people will stay with it, but some people won't. So we issued this disclaimer at the very beginning of the audiobook saying, when you think the book is done, it's not done. Just keep listening.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and we shortened the acknowledgments section as well, because when you look at it on the page, like, you can kind of skip over the acknowledgments, and you know there's still a half a book left, so you're going to keep turning the page, but you don't want to listen through all of that in the audio. And to expand on your question, even when I'm reading chapters out loud from my book, I adapt them. Yeah. There's a lot the chapter I read is like, there's tons of crossed out text and things I rewrite for the audio medium.
Yeah. It's the same, right? So I've got things like marked up and say like, we're not going to read that paragraph here. And like, yeah, I think we're constantly like adapting. This is very fixed, right? Like this book is fixed and it's like maybe the perfect representation. But it also like, it shifts over the years too. The things you choose to read, the things that are really important in the book, but they just don't work well for an audience. You can't track them, right? So, yeah. Do we have time for one more?
Go for a two-part question. Keep you guys speaking as long as possible. Firstly, why do you write? Big, broad question. And what are your major influences, cultural, personal, for why you write?
That's massive.
Sorry.
The why do you write?
Because I can start with that one.
Okay.
So I'm still answering that question for myself, I would say. When I began writing, my answer to that was, well, I have a bad memory, which is why I always had this compulsion to write everything down. And then I realized that's not quite why I write, and now my answer is more like, very hyperbolic. It's like I would suffer a psychological death if I did. Because I think writing for me is a way to make meaning out of life. And if something bad is happening to me, it's almost like I split into two different people. There's the person who's in the room with the bad thing, but then there's also another person who's maybe a little bit dissociated who's recording everything. And being a wallflower and saying, well, this is bad, yes, but we can make something out of this. This must be happening for a reason. And there's actually a chapter in this book where I write about, like, in kind of in the grieving process of the war, trying to understand it and what was happening to my relatives, there is that kind of bargaining phase in grief, right? And for me, that was kind of fantasy building. And I almost had this feeling of, oh, this war must be happening so that it could be written about. Right? That has to be why, right? Because there's no other sense, right? So, yeah, that's kind of my answer right now, but it might shift in the years.
Yeah, I think to sort of do like historically, when I started writing as a kid, it was just like I kept a bunch of diaries and kept a bunch of journals. And that was because I couldn't speak, right? I couldn't talk, say, within my family about what was going on there. And so the best I could do, if this had to be understood and expressed, I mean, you know, you're a 9-year-old boy, like, you just write it down, right? And I got a notebook, went to the dollar store, and, like, we just had these notebooks. And so there was a kind of necessity, right? They're, like one orifice here closed and I needed to sort of express in a different way. And so if you grow up alongside that kind of like habit or function or outlet, then I feel like my brain sort of got, like this was how I learned how to process things, right? Like by writing it. And so through university and beyond that. And so even when there was nothing painful or difficult to work through, I still wrote as a method of like understanding. And the second part, I think, is I also like to make things, right? So I was a very crafty kind of kid, like folding paper and like doing these kinds of things. Not like Becca, please don't read into it. But would like to sort of make it, got satisfaction from like bringing something to completion. And I think all that happened somewhere in late high school or early university was like the material just moved from something to words, right? Yeah, so that's the why. I really do like to make something and to have it exist in the world, yeah.
And in terms of influences, so part two of the question, there have been many, many influences. Margaret Lawrence, her book, Bird in the House, was the first linked story collection I read. I didn't know that that could even exist. And my first book is a linked story collection, so it was a direct influence there. Right now, specifically, I'm thinking of Edward Carey, who he's living in the UK now. But he taught me to look at every human flaw with love. And whether it's a physical flaw or a character flaw or whatnot, to not look at it from judgment, but from tenderness. Yeah, so I think even the most flawed characters in my work, I do have a tenderness for them. And the reader could judge them all they want, but I try to be open.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're like literary influences, people who are like your family. And I think everybody knows that, like how much I owe and love Margaret Atwood. And then there are these other kinds of arts, right? So I'm sure like opera, you could probably point to a bunch of things that have had a big influence. And I mean, there are these kinds of developmental things that happen. So I can listen to, I don't know, like a prelude or something like that and be able to sort of translate that into something that would work in a poem, right? So I get my inspiration from a different form altogether and then able to do it. And yeah, there's... yeah, okay.
That's good. That's for the after party. Okay.
That's good.
That's good.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, well, I think we have answered all the questions. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you to everybody in the audience who came out to this event. We do want to know about your experience here, so if you could log on to the KingstonWritersFest.ca, please let us know in our online survey. Now what you need to do is make sure that you have multiple copies of each of these books because Christmas is coming. It's like around the corner. So you want to get those books signed. So buy them in the festival bookstore and then you can meet our authors outside. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of the festival.
And you just heard from a September 21st, 2025 Kingston Writers Fest event called Wild Rides. And this was not yet aired on this show. You heard a conversation between authors Ian Williams and Maria Riva. Nearly 80-minute conversation and reading ran uninterrupted through the second hour. And just a reminder today that beginning in the next few minutes or so, you'll hear a second feature today, and it will be Harlequin Crowe's January 8th book launch at Novel Idea, so I hope you can stay tuned for that. It is about 24 and a half minutes after 5 o'clock, after 5 o'clock, and you have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM, streaming live every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. Here at www.cfrc.ca. And again, just a reminder that every week I do upload both hours of this show to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. Those will remain there for 3 years, and I usually do that and get that all done about 7 o'clock after I get home from the station. And I hope you can stay tuned for the second feature today. And just a short mention, I recorded 10 events in total, I believe, at the Kingston Writers Fest this past fall, and began airing them in, well, I think it was pretty early in January. And so I mentioned two. I think this is the sixth of those, so there are still four left, and I'll intersperse those in the next few weeks. We've got a few book launches and either having happened or are coming up, and so and readings and open mics and other things I'm going to work into to try to stay fairly current as well, but I will be working in more of those Kingston Writers Fest events, get those last four in here in pretty near future. So before we move on, I'd just like to extend my heartfelt thanks to all of you out there for having tuned into this nearly hour and a half, I guess, of this show today, and an equal thanks to Kingston Writers Fest, their staff and volunteers, and to Ian and Maria and all who were involved in and around that wonderful event. Now, before we move into that second portion of or the second feature, let's just call it that, for today, I do have a handful of recorded short announcements to share with you. Let me do that, and I'll be right back.
Folk Everything is your passport to the finest in folk music. Old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, it won't bother you. He's a busy man, he's got things to do.
It's all here Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Folk Everything with Hugh on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
Your library, your story. At the Kingston Frontenac Public Library, books are just the beginning. A library card starts a lifelong adventure, connecting you to everything you need to inspire learning, creativity, and fun. With 16 locations and plenty of online services, using your library has never been easier. Study in a quiet space, meet friends and learn new things, or explore the world through a magazine or a museum pass. Become a part of our story. Visit your local library branch or find us online at kfpl.ca.
Greetings, loved ones. This is DJ Nasty Nexus coming to you live and direct from CFRC 101.9. I'm here to bring you the goods from my new show, Classless Radio, airing every Friday night at 11 p.m. I'll be giving you hits and hidden gems all the way from jazz to blues and hip-hop and R&B. Music from the soul that everybody needs. Hop on my wavelengths and get right with the kid to kick off your big weekend. Stay tuned.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could borrow a musical instrument free of charge, just like you can borrow books from your local library? We think so too. That's why the Joe Chitlin Memorial Musical Instrument Lending Library, also known as Joe's Mill, has been lending guitars, keyboards, saxophones, and many other instruments to the Kingston community free of charge for almost 20 years. We are a registered charity, relying solely on the generosity of our community to donate their time, money, and instruments to keep this amazing service alive. Find us at www.joesmill.org or Joe's Mill on Facebook for more information on borrowing instruments or contributing to Joe's Mill.
And again, you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And welcome back officially into the final quarter of the show today. And it is, in fact, almost exactly 30 minutes after 5 o'clock. And in case you just tuned in, are listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM, again located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And as mentioned at the start of the first hour, coming up for the remainder of this second hour, and following the end of that Kingston Writers Fest event, you're now about to hear a second feature for the show today, and it is a January 8th Novel Idea Bookstore book launch reading with Harlequin Crowe, launching his debut book of poetry called Queer Holla. I do include now as well as I did at the start of the first hour, my usual start of the hour or new segment, I guess you could call that, announcement, is that occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. So here again is a January 8th Novel Idea Bookstore book launch reading with Harlequin Crowe, launching his or their debut book of poetry called Queer Holla. Here it is.
So I figured I would just kind of read a few selections, and if anybody wants to hear more, let me know, and we'll kind of wing it from there. Fabulous. A lifetime offers perhaps too much time to perfect wearing one personality. Locks it in once adolescence, ascribed era for experimentation, ends, leaving no room for newly discovered aspects of the self. A longing to be someone else. A killer queer who's utterly fabulous. Difficult in a world already imposing shadows over lights just trying to shine, obscuring desire to embrace what's locked in a million mental closets, hiding from the self. But, strangely, not everyone else. A killer queer who's utterly fabulous. But no spirit remains suppressed indefinitely, eventually bubbling through with tectonic intensity, a self unfurling like a battle flag, more than just some, well, more than crude expectations command. And finally, free. At least free enough to be someone who's sexy, quirky, flirty, and cute. Who's dainty, delicate, fierce, and feminine. A killer queer who's utterly fabulous. Who's utterly fabulous. Yeah, I'm going to be a little bit of a shit disturber. So this is one of those pieces, I hate giving preambles, I feel like the piece should speak for itself, but this is one of those ones where I've had a couple times where people are like, maybe that's a little too adult, and yada, and I'm like, okay, yes, it is about sex, but more importantly, it's about how men kind of are conditioned to suck, especially where sex is concerned. So, blame society, in other words. Beautiful orgasms. Can we talk about male orgasms, please? I would really like to. Why? Because we don't. Oh, we boast about banging, nailing, doing, screwing. Until a haze obscures any attempt at understanding. A kind of silence formed in wasted words. So, let's talk about this. About the spectrum of sensations between feeling the entire body melt, a seemingly eternal afterglow wreaking havoc with relativity, fading into ever smaller spasms. And the subtler side of experience, pleasures revealed in smaller moments, sometimes more satisfying for their nuance than any overwhelming of perceptions. Pleasant warming, lips parting, gentle sighs. Intimacy forged in physicality, entwining hearts grasping for one another's touch, and sometimes reaching something deeper, something rarer. Beautiful orgasms which set spirits alight, bathe being in beauty as tears cascade over cheeks flush with joy. So if anybody didn't know this in the crowd and couldn't figure this out from the cover photo, I am also a burlesque performer, and several of my colleagues came out tonight.
Yay.
Thank you guys. So I figured, why not one for the community? We are the burlesque. Who are we? Why, we are the fabulous, the glamorous, the sultry and salacious, the dainty and divine, the nerdy, the flirty, and the quirky. Those who like to work a crowd, sometimes silly, but always proud. We're full of feeling, always appealing, and never needing to hide. We're those who dance, prance, twirl, unfurl, sing, fling, reveal, and appeal, enchant and romance. We are the beautiful, the resolute, adorned in costumes both sexy and cute. We are the tricksters, so sorely needed in this day and age, showing love and sharing rage. In short, if I must digress, you see, we are the burlesque. Yeah, let's do a shorter one. Orienting. Some realizations require time, emerge only as moments accumulate desire in faster heartbeats, shorter breaths. Revelation articulated in internal spaces, private revelations, before it ever finds shape in words. Rainbow flames. My existence is a crime, punishable, at best, in public lacerations of flesh. Shame beaten into a body for daring closeness with another, as cane strokes strive to carve away more than blood and skin. Punishable, at worst, in state-sanctioned lynchings before a firing squad of stones, as each impact strives to destroy more than just a person. A life snuffed in hate, in pain. And yet, I'll rise in rainbow flames. My existence offends so greatly as to embolden bigots to make battlegrounds of bathrooms, banish from public space, public consciousness, anyone who fails adherence to the narrowest definition of normal. Existence overwhelmed through shame. And yet, again, I'll rise in rainbow flames. My existence is misunderstood, fodder for each adolescent wit who treats identities as insults, punchlines, and porn searches, each evoked in service of someone else's ego. Or worse, all those who dismiss integral truth as just a phase. But still, I'll rise in rainbow flames. So pierce me with the pins for affixing uncounted pink triangles, and march me towards more industrialized solutions, or claim divine providence justifies ignoring when my body is ravaged by a plague. Keep threatening your lake a fire of pain, then watch me rise in rainbow flames. Are we feeling more? Okay. Any ace. Let me tell you a story of love, of grace. A story in which our protagonist goes by Annie Ace. Now, Annie really loved to pun, hence her chosen name, and her other loves included knitting and baking and meeting friends for games. While Annie socialized at times, others she spent alone, but either way, she never lacked for friends to call her own. Among those friends, a multitude of he's and she's and they's from all across the rainbow spectrum, and a few were even straight. While some of her friends had found their match and settled down for life, others continued to play the field because that was what they liked. And among that crowd was Annie, who felt no need to date. But don't think she was lonely, our darling Annie Ace. The kind of love that Annie had offered all she ever craved, and in each friendship her heart found its embrace. Annie never wanted more, it just wasn't who she was. Instead, she was like some queer Buddha, not one for desire, but never lacking for love. And if you ever meet her, she might give you a hug with a smile on her face, and that's just the way she is, our darling Annie Ace. I gotta say, it's weird performing this one with, you know, this much clothing on, but, queer holla. Valkyries ride to a chorus, containing far more camp than Wagner ever envisioned. Rainbows adorning more than just the bridge beneath each hoofbeat. Warrior queens and kings who gather the fabulous fallen to a place beyond patriarchal pettiness, unbreached by the bigotries of various phobics. The halls of Queer Holla, hallowed in the clicks of a million cute pairs of heels, to celebrate and elevate those no longer condemned to isolation, desperation, and rejection. Halls where the only use for a closet is storing clothes, where no heart need harden in its own defense, and where everyone knows that love is love. So stare starwards for a glimpse of the Valkyrie's ride. Draw whatever hope it might provide, and know that when the time arrives, I'll see you in Queer Holla. Thank you so much for coming, everybody. As said, there are refreshments. Happy to chat and mingle. And this was awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Published author. And you just heard a January 18th a Novel Idea Bookstore, or I'm sorry, not January 18th, it was January 8th Novel Idea Bookstore book launch and reading with Harlequin Crowe launching their debut book of poetry, again called Queer Holla. And tell you what, let's do this and I'll be right back.
They're Harlequin.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music. a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast to Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Partners in Mission Food Bank could not exist without the loyalty, dedication, and support of volunteers, some of whom have been with us for over 30 years. Our team of volunteers consists of individuals who continually devote both their time and skills on a regular basis in an effort to make a positive impact on hunger and the food needs of the community. Volunteering has no age limits. Your commitment and energy is enough. It is a great way to make new friends and contribute to your community. Partners in Mission Food Bank volunteers provide essential services in many ways, including assembling daily hampers, sorting food donations, breaking down and portioning bulk items, packing eggs into cartons, keeping the warehouse safe and clean, and providing helpful input to other volunteers and staff. Interested in volunteering with Partners in Mission Food Bank? Please call our volunteer coordinator at 613-544-4100.
Hello and welcome to Salt Licht in Rapture. I'm your host, Nishan Tung. Salt Licht in Rapture is a sonic exploration of, to quote Virginia Woolf, violent waves of emotion. Featuring both known and lesser known musicians and poets, a special emphasis is placed on oddball, enigmatic, outsider artists whose work invokes dreamscapes and feelings of alienation, nostalgia, melancholy, existential unease, and yearning. Join me on Fridays at 8 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM.
And welcome back again. The time is, it just turned 47 minutes after 5 o'clock. And getting quite close now to the end of the show. I do have some I'm going to just concentrate on events today, I think, that are coming up, because there are a few coming up next week, actually. And before I do that, though, I do want to thank you for having tuned in so far to the show today. And to listen to both the event in the first hour and the book launch that you just heard by Harlequin Crowe. So I do want to thank Harlequin and also Kingston Writers Fest staff, volunteers, and their guests who were part of the event, and also to Ian and Maria again for their wonderful conversation and readings from their books. So again, thank you all, and you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Again, we are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online at www.cfrc.ca. And a quick mention that I said I'm going to share a few events, but I'm also going to play a song at the end of the show, so I hope you can stay tuned for all of it. How's that? And just one more reminder, in case you didn't hear it earlier, every week I upload both hours of this show to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. They do remain there for 3 years, and I usually get that done, get the hours uploaded to that blog space now right around 7 o'clock. So it's when I usually get it all done. So, and also before I get into the events, I don't want to forget this. Coming up right at the top of the hour, 2 hours of East Coast music in a show called Saltwater Music, hosted by Rob Carnell. So I hope you can stick around for that, too. He always has a great show. And, okay, I mentioned at the very start of the show that we were moving into book launch. Our book launch is happening, and there are three of them actually happening next week. Greer Struthers is with their book, Apparently, Sir Cameron Needs to Die. It's a book launch on February 24th, which is Tuesday, next Tuesday. We'll be reading from their new book again, Apparently Sir Cameron Needs to Die. It will be happening at 7 o'clock. And then on the following night, yeah, Wednesday, February 25th at 7 o'clock at Novel Idea Bookstore. I should have said that the first one, or maybe I did or didn't, but I know I didn't give you the address. 156 Princess Street, so right on the corner of Princess and Bagot. And on February 25th, you're going to hear there Ann Archer and Calista Markotich with also a group or with a duo, Shenanigans, who'll be performing a bit of music as well. That's Ann and John McClurg at Novel Idea Bookstore, again, 156 Princess Street, 7 p.m. And then also on February 26th, Paul Akpomuje with Black Passport, a migrant's memoir book launch. That's happening at Modern Fuel. This is Modern Fuel is in the TET Center Suite 305, which is at 370 King Street West in Kingston. That's where the TET Center is. Go to Modern Fuel, Modern Fuel's website to check out and see it. I think there might still be tickets available, but the book he's launching is, in fact, I'm going to read, it says from their website, he's the first recipient of the International Ontario Graduate Scholarship in the Faculty of Education at Queen's, and will read from his new collection of poetry, again called Black Passport, A Migrant's Memoir. And I'm very much looking forward to that. Also coming up, then, the end of the week, Lit Live, or this isn't in Kingston, Lit Live reading series in Hamilton. They meet September through June, just about always the first Sunday of the month. So this will be coming up a week from Sunday. It's going to be March 1st. That's crazy. and February's kind of slipping by. And so anyway, this does happen at the Staircase Cafe and Theater, which is at 27 Dundurn Street North in Hamilton. It's pay what you can at the door. So they do suggest $5 to $10, though. And that begins at 7 p.m. Best way to find out more about that, go to their Facebook page. They do have a Facebook page, and they update there. I don't think I have a website handy to give you. And let's see. And what I'll do is then I'll just kind of move into the very first part of the next week. We've got the first Tuesday night, two open mic series. One here in Kingston called And the Journey Continues. That's doors at 6:30 Tuesday again, March 3rd, 7 to 9:15 p.m. The Elm Cafe, 303 Montreal Street. Then there is one in Madoc as well. And it's called First Tuesday Muse. It is a First Tuesday Night of the Month event as well. And it is held at Finn's Pub and Patio, which is at 231 Durham Street South in Madoc. Their event runs from 7 to 9 p.m. Also, beginning this Wednesday is, let me go back to my page here, see if I've got any additional information about it, but it is the start of the Kingston Canadian Film Festival. It is runs from Wednesday, February 25th to through Sunday, March 1st. The Kingston Canadian Film Festival is the largest festival in the world dedicated exclusively to Canadian film. So I hope you can check that out. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and play that song. And again, I hope you can stay tuned to Saltwater Music at the top of the hour. Also, take care and have a great week. But you're going to hear, to get us there, Joni Mitchell with a song called Cactus Tree. That was recorded in 1967, and it was a cut then off of her first album, her very first album, Song to a Seagull, released in March of 1968. Probably one of my favorite of her songs, actually. So anyway, again, Joni Mitchell with Cactus Tree. Thank you so very much for tuning in today, and I hope you all have a great week, and stay safe out there, and I'll catch you here again next week. Thanks.
There's a man who's been out sailing in a decade full of dreams, and he takes her to a schooner, and he treats her like a queen, bearing beads from California with her amber stones and green. He has called her from the harbor, he has kissed her with his freedom, he has heard her off starboard in the breaking and the breathing of the water weeds, while she was busy being free. There's a man who's climbed a mountain and he's calling out her name, and he hopes her heart can hear. 3,000 miles he calls again. There beside him, he can miss her just the same. He has missed her in the forest, while he showed her all the flowers, and the branches sang the chorus as he climbed the scaly towers of a forest tree, while she somewhere being free. There's a man who sent a letter and he's waiting for reply. He has asked her of her travels since the day they said goodbye. He writes, "Wish you were beside me. We can make it if we try." He has seen her at the office, with her name on all his papers, through the sharing of the profits, he will find it hard to shake her from his memory. And she's so busy being free. There's a lady in the city, and she thinks she loves them all. There's the one who's thinking of her, there's the one who sometimes calls, there's the one who writes her letters with his facts and figures scrawl. She has brought them to her senses, they have laughed inside her laughter. Now she rallies her defenses, for she fears that one will ask her for eternity. And she's so busy being free. There's a man who sends her medals, he's bleeding from the war. There's a jouster and a jester and a man who owns a store. There's a drummer and a dreamer, and you know there may be them when she sees them. They will lose her if they follow, and she only means to please them, and her heart is full and hollow like a cactus tree, while she's so busy being free. Like a cactus tree. being free.